Five Talks on 5FM with Nick Hammond. Share stories, change attitudes, celebrate people, talk loud, listen loud, live loud. Five Talks on 5FM.
It's Mango Groove, special star as mentioned. For the next hour on Five Talks, Claire Johnston is here. There's a reason, Claire, that I've chosen that song. It's not just because, you know, let's say it's obvious, 25 times over platinum, etc. Iconic South African anthem. But because of something you said about it recently in an interview, I could and will throughout the hour get into every reason for wanting to speak to somebody like Claire Johnston. But I think most accurately, and for me, what's most significant as an introduction into who you are is that you get to become a symbol of what it means to be a certain type of South African, which I think is something that very few people get to say that they're a part of.
That's overwhelmingly lovely of you. Thank you.
And thank you for coming in, and thank you for
speaking to us.
The next hour. The reason that I played Special Star quite specifically, I read an interview that you did recently, and I imagine there's a hell of a lot of press at the moment, obviously with the 30-year anniversary and the concerts happening in Monte Cassino next month, and we'll, of course, plug and get into all of that. But what I found really interesting, and this is something that somebody who hasn't been in a successful band probably won't understand.
Okay.
But I remember you saying that there was a time that Special Star, you came to hate it because of how big it had become.
Yes.
And you've recently sort of 360'd on that and gone back to liking it again.
Exactly. That's perfectly said.
How do you explain that to somebody who hasn't been in a band that's had major hits? Because they wouldn't get it. Because the way that they would think of it is like, well, of course you love that. I mean, that's Special Star. We all love it.
Yeah. I think what happens is you're in the industry long enough to eventually just become supremely grateful that there are songs that you've made that make people feel so good and that people respond so amazingly to. Whereas when you start out and you are lucky enough to have success, you go through a bit of a phase of wanting to sort of indulge yourself. So I'll never forget with the Another Country album, which came out in 1993, I just wanted us to perform just Another Country songs. Didn't want to do Special Star. Didn't want to do Moments Away. And you've actually got to give an audience what the audience wants, because that's the whole point. Yes, you're doing it for yourself as well. You've got to please yourself, but you've also got to give people what they want. And I've got to the point now where I just love when Special Star starts. And I leave the stage and the song starts and Temba steps forward and starts playing those first notes, those first beautiful haunting notes, and the audience just erupts. And so I'm standing backstage and I'm watching this and I'm getting so excited to come on stage halfway through the song I'm running on. And by the time I come on, the audience goes hysterical all over again. So it's just become this amazing experience where sometimes I step forward in front of the mic and I almost don't know if I'm going to be able to sing, because sometimes it's so loud, audience is so loud, that I'm thinking, okay, where is that note again? You know, where the star? So it's become very emotional doing the song. So there's just oodles of gratitude. And I think that's what happens when you've been in the industry long enough, is you start looking back the way we're doing now with this 30th anniversary concert. You start looking back and being grateful.
What do you think is, for you personally, Claire, like the central point of reflection? Because you're going to constantly be asked, you know, 30 years, what does it mean?
Yes.
30 years, what does it mean? Eventually, there's a time when you're at home by yourself and then you actually ask yourself the question.
Now, what does this actually mean to me?
Yeah.
Wow, that's a good one. I think it is just that sense of, you know, looking back, you know, we've been compiling a program for the shows, and it's looking amazing, and we've been going through press clippings, and there's a sudden sense of how long this journey has been, how intense it's been. And I suppose for me, it's a sense of, my goodness, I was a little girl when I joined the band. I mean, I was 17. Looking back now, years later, I see that I was a child at 17. And now I'm a woman. I've grown up in the band. I mean, I'm not completely grown up. Hopefully, that's just an ongoing process.
I think so.
I think for all of us. You know, you don't want to become too grown up. So it's that. It's that sense of, wow, I've had one hell of a journey, and I'm still young. There's still lots more. So I'm feeling, you know, I'm feeling really good about everything.
You'd said also that as that 17-year-old in Greenside High in Johannesburg, that you kind of became woken up by being introduced into at that time would still have been a relatively fresh concept, a crossover band.
That's right.
Just before the state of emergency in South Africa, really difficult time. Yeah. But you'd also said in retrospect, honestly as well, that it wasn't like, you know, you'd come from a long-standing tradition of being particularly politically aware. The band sort of allowed that to happen for
you. Yes, exactly. I mean, I was a product of the Transvaal Education Department, and it was a very good education in some ways, but that's actually one of the reasons I went on. Instead of studying drama at Wits, I decided to do English politics and philosophy because I felt it was going to just flesh out my sense of the world, help me think, you know, and let me understand the idea, the notion of concepts. And then, as you say, meeting the rest of the band and starting to go to Alex occasionally for something like a funeral and just seeing another reality was eye-opening, and my life changed forever.
Because everyone looks at the success that Mango Groove has had, and you kind of obviously assume that it always had that. But I mean, there must have been a long period of time when you guys, you probably had quite a cult following, I would have imagined.
You're so right. We did have a cult following. It started very small. It started off at, because we couldn't play everywhere as a mixed race band. You couldn't go everywhere. So we'd play at certain venues, and a little bit of a buzz developed around us. We were signed to a record deal. We released a single to radio. And the excitement when I first heard that on the radio, I think I was still in a trick. I was beside myself, actually. I was like, well, this is real. This is real. It's actually happening, you know. So there was a little bit of exposure in you know, on television, and we even did a music video, I think, for the song Two Hearts. But yeah, very much a garage band, not a garage band, cult band sort of thing. And I guess garage band to some extent. And then in about 87, we started traveling nationally. We started doing things like varsity campuses and going on sort of road shows and things like that with some sponsorship. And that's when we really started to sort of, I guess, get better on stage as opposed to just sort of me standing there being awkward.
I know Two Hearts was the first song that had played on radio.
Yes.
But I wasn't sure which radio station that was, because I would imagine that there would have been a lot of radio, anything in this building in particular, that wouldn't have obviously allowed at that time. Am I right? I mean,
oddly,
multiracial band to be
on
air.
Yes, oddly, we did. We did get played on various stations. Now, bear in mind, it was such a different landscape in those days. I mean, how many radio stations are there in South Africa now? I mean, I don't even know.
There's 19 at the SABC alone.
There you are. In those days, there were very few. And I think we were certainly played on the equivalent of SAFM.
Right.
Possibly what was called Radio 5 in those days.
Yeah.
I think Radio 5 may have played us. I think Highveld, which is now 94.7. I think they possibly played us. But no, it was a lot of SABC. But those were all radio. They were all, weren't they? Highveld was even an SABC station in those days.
It was,
right. It was all SABC. So no, we did have, you know, a smattering of play, which was exciting. But it's really only in 88 that we were approached by a group of investors who wanted to record a really, really expensive, quality, well-produced album with us. And that's when we worked on that very first album, Mango Groove, which is the one that we're celebrating 30 years of in 10 days' time.
Do you ever reflect back on what it was that they saw in the band at that time, at those early stages? Because, you know, it didn't have the legacy yet. It didn't have.
Certainly didn't. I think they sensed there was something interesting, that maybe they thought maybe the timing was good, because for us, you know, we had been to some extent floundering around, just doing our thing. They obviously sensed there was something, dare I say, special or certainly marketable. It was an unusual combination of people. It was a very South African sound. I'm guessing that's what they were thinking. But of course, when things exploded for us in 1989, a lot of people who hadn't been aware of Mango Groove thought, oh, this was just like an easy put-up job type thing.
Always what people think.
Always think it, you know, let's get a blonde singer and let's get this person to do this and this person to do that. And
that's the winning recipe.
And that's the winning recipe. And meanwhile, not at all. You know, we were very organic and fumbling around.
Did you think about whether or not you were going to study necessarily? Because, I mean, obviously, you know, joining the band at 17, still being in matric, and then going to Wits pretty much right after that, and doing politics, philosophy, and English, exact same thing that I studied just slightly earlier. There must have been a bit of pressure to be like, well, do I need to do this now? I mean, the trajectory of the band's going in a certain way, or was it always like, I'm studying regardless?
No, I was going to do drama, and in fact, my mum was very disappointed when I said I don't feel like doing drama anymore. I think I'd rather do something more serious, I suppose. She was disappointed because she'd been supporting me in my desire to be a singer and an actress since I was 10.
I was in Annie when I was 10.
So that's when it became clear, I think, to my mum and my stepdad that this is something, you know, Claire could probably do.
What was the climate like at Wits back in those days, in the 80s? Because, I mean, yeah. We know, generally speaking, that Wits has always been more liberal than most, even back in the day it was. Mm. But I can't imagine what it was like studying that kind of material at a time where there's a state of emergency going on in the country.
No, you're absolutely right. There were security police were always on campus, usually on Friday afternoons. I remember Madikizela Mandela, the late Winnie Mandela, she came to speak one afternoon. And sure enough, she was allowed to speak. And then, of course, the security police arrived. And I never forget my boyfriend and I, there was a photographer taking photographs. And then the security police were headed for him. And he managed to sneak us a roll of film. And we managed to get the film to his to his newspaper. Because that's how it was. Information was suppressed. I'll never forget getting a copy of a more liberal newspaper. And what they'd very cleverly done the one day is they'd printed a nice big fat version of their paper. But what they'd done is they'd shown all the things that were to be censored. They'd blacked them all out. So actually, the newspaper should have been 3 pages long in terms of all the censorship that had gone on.
Mm.
It was actually astonishing to see how much information was being suppressed.
What's it like growing up sort of in the public eye from a very young age? Because so I'm 28 years old now, and I started having like a national audience from the age of around 20.
Wow.
And so only now, for the first time, and it's always like back of my mind kind of thought that it comes up every now and then.
Mm.
But I've often found like that it's very weird because you're thinking of yourself in a public sense in the one way, which very often makes it very easy to not have to look all that inwardly necessarily.
Yes.
And then I imagine at some point you realize that.
With me, I've always been a bit of an introspector, and I've always been a little bit too hard on myself. I've had to watch that overthinking thing, where I'm imagining something that actually isn't there. I'm imagining I'm anxious where actually I shouldn't be anxious. I can see, looking back now at the person who started out in Mango Groove at 17, I look back and I track that person, and I just think, wow, you spent so much time so worried about what people thought about you, and meanwhile you were doing fine. You were, you know, a young woman in an industry that's very difficult, and you were doing a good job. So I, you know, you want to sort of go back and shake yourself and say, listen, enjoy this. Stop making such a big deal out of everything. Not everyone's looking at you all the time. I'm very self-conscious,
right?
Still.
So am I.
Yeah. And it's a painful thing sometimes.
But don't you often find in retrospect as well, when you look back at your younger self and all the, honestly speaking, incredibly brave decisions you would have had to have made time and time again, then you look back older and wiser and go like, sure, I don't even know how I did that.
That's exactly right. I agree with you. I think sometimes it's very good to throw yourself into something you're passionate about when you're young. I'm not saying it's ever too late. It's just that as you get older, you become so much more careful, so much more risk averse, so much more aware of what might go wrong as opposed to what might actually go right. So this is something I talk to myself about all the time. I mean, I'll have fantasies of, I'll imagine myself on stage and the absolute worst thing happens. You know, whatever that may be, it's me falling off the stage, it's everyone laughing at me, things that have never actually happened.
Highly unlikely.
And yeah, I mean, I haven't yet. But, you know, so there's all of that, when you're young, go for it. Absolutely follow your dreams.
And then does there become a point where you're able to stop for a second and then just say like, wow, we're big now. We're huge. I mean, like, you know, as Mango Groove, you get to that point where the world looking in, it's very easy for them and for us to go and say that's an iconic act, that's hugely, widely successful. But I mean, does it happen for you where you're like...
Not really, because, you know, I don't think you can ever take anything for granted. And you mustn't ever assume that it's just, you know... I don't know. I don't take anything for granted. I I take every show very seriously. Every show makes me nervous. Every show, even every interview, is sort of, for me, is something that might be not a disaster, but it's to be handled carefully and seriously, and yet with joy at the same time. And we do on stage, we have huge amounts of fun. When I'm on stage, while it's happening, then it's all good. But just thinking about it is where I tie myself up into knots.
Gotcha.
Sometimes still.
Up until the 11th hour.
Up until the 11th and a half hour. Is this such a...
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Absolutely, right until it's go time.
Oh, yes, right.
With Claire Johnston on Five Talks, talking about the 30-year anniversary of Mango Groove. And I'd ask now, just ahead of the break, to Claire, like with all the press that's going on, yeah, what you think people are most interested in. You'd spoken, obviously, the time of the 80s and
yes,
and the fact that it was an abnormal thing to be
yes,
going
for,
on.
Yes, for South Africans to... For South Africans to sort of have... Black and white South Africans to have any kind of normal, positive, healthy... you know, interaction, you know, it was a dehumanizing thing that was going on in those days. And so people are fascinated, like, how did it happen? How did it start? And of course, the answer is John Layden is a founding member who was in love with the styles of Marabi and Kwela from the townships in the 50s and 60s. And he grew up listening to that music and he started a punk band called Pet Frog. So Mango Groove actually has its origins in a punk band called Pet Frog. Pet with two T's, by the way.
Do you ever think, so given the context of the time then, it being the 80s in South Africa, Mango Groove doing what they're doing is coming from the outside and forcing it inward. So it's like you're doing something that is impermissible and you're attempting to make it permissible.
Yes.
But at the same time, from a pure music perspective, what you're doing is you're taking different sounds that you're interested in and you're creating something new from that. I mean,
yes,
that's an artistic pursuit. But in 2019, we live in a very different world and we live in a very different country,
yes,
where the two are now separate in a very different way. We've had a very different political history and the history has now happened and a very different current situation.
Yeah.
But we still have musicians who, as in an artistic pursuit, will take music and sounds and genres from anywhere. But that can get viewed differently. How do you think Mango, what would Mango Groove be if they were formed in 2019?
That is such an interesting question. It's a very tough one to answer. I have absolutely no idea, because you're right. I mean, the whole context is different. So, in fact, just to quote our late great trumpeter Banza Khaswane, who's also the father of Moti from Mikasa. That's right. He had a wonderful saying. He spoke about Mango Groove's music as being more than music, because of the time it was emanating from. So yes, you're right. For Mango Groove to start now in 2019, where black and white South Africans are free to do what they like, pretty much when they like, with whom they like. We have a great constitution. We're a democracy. It's a very different scenario, a very different context. So I don't know. I mean, almost can't answer that question.
And where, and I mean, you know, because Johnny Clegg was in recently.
Yes.
And there are plenty of parallels, you know, between the Mango Groove and Johnny Clegg. And and we were sort of talking about the same thing. And he was talking about how it was so interesting how, you know, nowadays when it comes to just the concept of history in general, there are a lot of people of my generation that don't necessarily have that greater sense of awareness of what it necessarily meant to be doing something back in the day, because
I would agree with that.
It's a story now,
yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
And the nuances and the complexities often get left out because it's very difficult to translate an actual time into the minds of somebody who wasn't there.
No, absolutely, absolutely. It's almost impossible to do that. I think we were privileged. Mango Groove was privileged to be formed at a time where music really meant a lot.
I've seen it. You did an interview recently where you'd said that. You said that you have this honest feeling that music did just mean more at that time than it does now.
It was such a different scene generally, just in terms of how people listened to music, how they consumed music. I mean, it was nothing like, you know, the digital experience we have now. I mean, everything was, you know, saving up your money and going to buy your 7-inch single or your vinyl or your cassette, and then later on your CD. And as we were saying earlier, there were sort of very few radio stations, it was very easy to get to almost everybody. So in 89, when that album came out, we were playlisted by pretty much every radio station in South Africa and played on every TV channel. And I think there were three. And everyone watched and listened to the same things. Well, to a large extent. But you really, I mean, by and large. But you really could get to most South Africans. Whereas now, you've got to do so much more to get to everybody. Because there's so many different platforms and so many different radio stations and streaming services and, you name it.
What do you make of the South African music industry at the moment? I mean, I'd imagine you keep your ear quite close to the ground.
Not close enough sometimes. I mean, I think there are always interesting things going on. I think it's tough. I'm not sure how many venues there are for artists. And that's a sadness because I think people really do love going and seeing live music. I love the very healthy festival scene. That's been very good to us. We've done a lot of that, and hopefully we'll do more.
And you
in the
still
future.
Do remarkably well at the festival scene, which is really fantastic to see because it doesn't always work like that.
No, the first one we did was Opikopi in 2013, and we thought, what are they thinking? We just had because we'd been just as just to go and see it, just to hang out. And when they booked us, I was thinking, should we even say yes? And I actually couldn't believe it. I mean, during Moments Away, I couldn't hear myself sing. I basically just handed over to the audience. They knew every word.
I've seen this happening firsthand. I mean, it is remarkable because I've got a lot of friends who are bookers, and I remember when there was in the last 5 years this resurgence of like, we've got this iconic act, like let's start putting them on festival lineups again.
Yes.
So I know like Henk and the guys that do sort of the park acoustic side of the world.
Yes.
I've seen that, and I've seen obviously the Opikopi stuff, Gareth and them, and I know you guys played up the creek like 2 years ago.
We did,
which I just got off playing 2 weeks ago now.
Oh, awesome.
And at all these festivals, either I was there to have seen it or somebody had said to me, they're like, you would not believe the as Mango Groove as big as ever to a completely new audience.
Yeah, we're astonished and, just thrilled. It's beyond belief, to be honest. So thanks for, to everyone who booked us for trusting us to actually do it where we possibly wouldn't have thought it
so there
possible.
Wasn't like a strategy on the back end of your management team going, guys, let's it's time now, I think
I think it was actually Carl and Misha, I think, took a chance on us on Opikopi in 2013, and I think that's kind of how we started doing that sort of circuit. And it's such fun. It's just, I feel like I'm at varsity again, playing at the Bazzoli. We did one gig at the Bazzoli, and I'm right back there to that sort of energy and craziness. I just feed off
back.
It.
It's a wonderful thing. Does it, if you look at like sort of writing an album in 2016, when you've had, I suppose, an you as an artist are aware of an expectation. You're not just writing something, shooting in the dark, hoping that people like it. You've already got this legacy behind you and this history behind you.
Yeah.
What is it like writing something in that, knowing all of that?
You're right. You do feel a bit, self-conscious is too strong a way of putting it, but there is an awareness of, Mango Groove has a sound, and that's who we are. So it's a question of writing songs that just kind of happen naturally. That's why we're not massively prolific. I think we're, we do things when we're ready to do them. And with that last album, Face It to the Sun, it started off as a concept album. It was going to be called
South African Songbook.
Exactly. So John and I sat down, we compiled a list of our favorite South African songs, and then we had a wish list of people we'd like to collaborate with. And we got so lucky, we got everyone we wanted, which was fabulous. And then having recorded that piece of the album, John suddenly said, he's feeling creative stirrings to write new material. So it became a double album, where the first album is the tribute, some of our very favorite South African songs. And then the second one is brand new material, which, I think there's some wonderful songs on that album. A song called Kind, a ballad, which for me, just the message is very important right now.
What is that message?
About being kind in this world. The whole world, I don't know about you, but the whole world to me is feeling like it's a bit mad.
Yeah.
And a bit cruel and a bit crazy. And I think kindness is everything, actually. And sometimes it means being kind to yourself. you know, we're so unpleasant to ourselves. You know, that voice you have in your head sometimes where you just think, no one else speaks to you like that. Why are you speaking to yourself like that?
Completely.
You know, I think that's true for a lot of us. And I think, you know, as much as I'm becoming fairly good on social media and all of that, I think social media is hard on people. I think we're living in a strange and slightly scary time where we need to just remember who we are and be kind to ourselves.
Do you get the sense that there was a moment in South Africa that felt a lot more euphoric than things feel now?
Oh, absolutely. The build-up to the elections in 1994, where we were lucky enough to be part of that big concert that was satellite-linked around the world, and there was the flyover, there was the flag, there was the 21-gun salute. There was a sense of huge optimism and possibility, a new dawn. South Africa was finally, well, never mind not being a pariah, we were being applauded and celebrated and looked at with admiration. And of course, that was a very, very heady time because, my God, we'd gone through tough times to get there. I mean, prior to the elections, the country was on the brink of civil war. So there was that enormous relief of we got through it and there's, you know, it's happened. We have a democratically elected president. We have the inauguration. It doesn't get better than that. And then, of course, it's back to business. It's back to running a country. It's back to a country kind of moving forward into the future with everything, hopefully everything to play for, but carrying a lot of baggage. And I think that's where we are now. I'm still optimistic. I'm very optimistic. I have a huge fan of South Africans. I think we're amazing people. And I continue to be optimistic. But I think we've got a lot ahead of us. We're dealing with a lot at the moment.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
You know, that's just how it is.
Because for me, I feel completely, one day to the next, I feel different about things.
It's quite bipolar.
Yeah,
isn't it?
I have this idea that most of us as South Africans are, unfortunately, because of history, suffering from some sort of type of schizophrenia, where it's impossible.
I would completely agree with you. I think so. I think it's part of why we're so amazing, because we're very resilient and very creative and actually very optimistic, I believe. And, you know, I just think we need to realize that about ourselves. I still believe that South Africans suffer from collective low self-esteem.
Oh, totally.
I'm honest with you. I don't think we realize, I don't think we still feel good enough. And that bothers me because we really are. We're actually amazing.
And you talk about that as, you know, that ability to share that through music. I mean, I think I think music has always been, throughout our history, something that a lot of different South Africans have looked to as a
form of
escape and a form of empowerment and a form of collective understanding.
That's right. It does what sport does. But, you know, back in the day, sport didn't really do that because it was all very polarized and we certainly weren't on the international stage with sport.
Right.
You know, the way sport now, just what it does to the national mood. Music did that then. Music brought people together. There was a series of huge concerts called the Big Concerts, which were held at Ellis Park in the late 80s into the early 90s. And those were fabulous because you'd have South Africans of all walks of life, different ages, because I'm obsessed with that. I'm obsessed with the fact that music isn't polarizing. Music's actually inclusive. And that's what these shows used to do. So you'd have Johnny Clegg, you'd have us, you'd have Brenda Fassie, you'd have some rock bands, you'd have a whole bunch of South African artists on this wonderful stage, this amazing platform, beautiful production values, and South Africans just coming and celebrating their South Africanness. And we need more of that. And I think that's what some of the festivals are doing, which is wonderful.
And I think it's such an interesting, you talk about that late 80s time that a lot of people forget. We had Yvonne Chaka Chaka in on
the
show.
Oh, did you? Okay, yes.
And she also, obviously, you know, part of that generation, Princess of Africa and Mango Groove and Johnny Clegg and Brenda Fassie and all that. And one thing that she remarked was really interesting that I think a lot of us have forgotten as well, that and you were talking about this now, Claire, but the size of those concerts.
Oh, they were epic.
You know, and for good reason, we talk about very proudly when, you know, Casper fills up stadiums and things, but we forget that you guys were doing that.
Well, and Mango was particularly lucky. We, Standard Bank Arena, which holds, I think, 6,000 people, we did 7 shows in a row.
Wow.
7 shows in a row in, I think it was 1990. And the 7th show, we had to put on the 7th show because I think the 6th show had been pirated. So we had to do another show basically for free for the people who'd been.
What do you mean by the show was pirated?
The tickets had been
scalped off.
Yes. So there'd be fraudulent tickets made or something. So we had to put on a seventh show. And that's the first time I ever saw Mexican Wave, where the audience sort of was doing this whole. I was thinking, what are they doing? And I realized, whoa, that's amazing.
Don't you? I mean, what does it feel like? You must have this amazing sense of sort of like superstardom when you walk out into a stage of that size.
It's not that at all. It's more a sense of, oh my goodness. I hope we can live up to this. Let's not mess this up.
But that's the interesting thing, isn't it? Hey, because you know, to an outsider,
yes.
You've somehow attained a new level of being a human. Like, yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like
I guess I do.
You get given the cape at some point, then when you put it on, the entire emotional, social, spiritual, mental, and physical alters itself into this completely like gold-plated superior version.
I see. I'm gonna carry that with me. I like that.
Well, that's what the public assumes.
But you know, speaking as a member of the public, you're absolutely right, because I'll see artists where, and I'm in the audience and I'm caught up with all this energy and I'm waiting, and then sure enough, on comes the band or the artist, and there's that sense of and then you just assume that they are feeling like king or queen or whatever of the world.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, maybe they're feeling like I do, which is like a sense of, oh God, I could do this.
Of course they are. Because the one thing that no matter what happens in life that you can't unfortunately change is, or fortunately actually, but is that you're a human. I mean, that's the one thing that will never ever leave you.
That is so right. You know, that's a good thing. Our humanity.
Course, yeah.
That positive aspect of it.
And not becoming too jaded, which I do think happens to some certain people.
You've really got to watch that. That happens around the time where you're starting to sort of disregard your audience and say, no, but I want to play. I just want to play new tracks. Right. Or I want to do new versions of the old songs. And you've got to watch yourself. You're on that jaded, taking for granted sort of trajectory if you're not careful.
Do you ever, and I mean, you know, let's not be salacious, I'm not name mentioning anything, but do you ever, now that you are doing the festival scene again after a long time of having crushed it, and you obviously meet and interact with a lot of different acts from all across the African musical landscape, do you ever meet younger people and then go, you're going down a bad path, and I wish that I could just shake you and say I understand what it's like to be like you, and I think that you're losing touch.
I experienced arrogance the other day. I experienced something that I don't like experiencing, and I'm not going to name names. We were at a festival in Cape Town, and there was a young artist who I've worked with before. And what happened is he didn't recognize me. I hadn't put on my makeup and, you know, so I just went up to him and I said, hey, lovely to see you. He didn't recognize me and he was completely dismissive. An hour later, he saw me and he was all over me. And I thought, you know what, and I didn't speak to him, but I was thinking, you know what, this is not good. This is not good. You don't suddenly treat some people, you know, differently than others. It's that lovely thing about if you're going on a date with someone, don't look at how they treat you. Look at how they treat the wait staff.
Sure.
Because that's who they are. So it's that sort of thing where I see that sort of arrogance where someone's sort of feeling a little bit untouchable and, no, I'll only speak to this person and I'll only speak to that person. That's very unattractive. Mm. And it's a long way down. Good luck with that.
Oh, yeah. I remember doing a show. And again, I won't mention the negative articles. There's just no point.
No.
But the positive guy in the story, the hero of the story was DJ Fresh.
Oh, yes. He's
so
lovely.
There was a band that was playing who'd had like a big hit on the radio. Mm. But just this one big hit. Mm. And everybody had to make a compromise because things were running late. You know how these things are. They booked too many acts for the lineup and
absolutely.
Then suddenly. So everyone's set time had to get eaten into, and nobody wants this to happen, but there was reality. Everyone's set time had to get eaten into a little bit.
Yeah.
With the exception of this one band who refused because at the time they were the biggest act.
No.
So Fresh, without even batting an eyelid, was like, it's cool, I'll do like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And he was fine, and then he got off the stage, and he was bigger than they are.
Yeah, that's right.
Even at the time when they were number one. And I was like, dude, why? Like, you're like a heritage act yourself. You've been around, 30-odd years. And he was like, yo, dude, ask me about these guys in 2 years' time.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you, and he was right, by the way. Yeah. No one, I don't think they've done a thing since.
No, that's right. It's very unattractive when people do that. You've got to play the game. You're on a stage with other people, you're part of a collective. When you do these festivals, You know, you don't. We've had it where we've had a beautiful slot at a festival. Wonderful, the best. In our view, the best slot.
Yes.
And the person who's meant to be on before us decides to arrive late, so that we're forced to go on earlier, and that she gets the sweet spot. And I was very struck by that. We actually refused. We would have said, all right. But in this instance, this person was being a diva.
Exactly. And you just, all that you're doing is, and forgive you, is asking for a bit of respect.
That's right. That's right. But if it's a question of cutting our set short to make way for, of course we'd do that. Absolutely. You're part of this event.
Mm. I heard recently that you'd done some work with and would like to potentially try and collaborate with Amanda Black, I think.
Think she's awesome.
She's great.
Yeah.
Are there other people as well that you've sort of you've been looking at and going like, that's cool?
Oh, there's lots. I'd love to do all sorts of weird and wonderful things. Just speaking as myself, as opposed to, you know, my Mango Groove persona, because I as a singer, I'd like to try all sorts of interesting, strange things, knowing that I'm safe with my musical home with Mango Groove. There are lots of interesting people. A lot of the sort of younger, kind of more left of center people.
Totally.
I'm obviously a big Jeremy Loops fan.
Yeah.
Amanda Black is epic. There's a huge amount of talent in this country.
I'm sure the Jeremy Loops thing could be set up. I mean, he's a wonderful guy, and I've got a lot of time for him.
Yes, he seems like a genuine, down to earth kind of person.
Yeah, we were in a dimly lit bar in Cape Town, knocking back tequilas a few months ago, and just really, really getting to hear his work ethic and what he's really about. It's a beautiful. I'm sure he'd love to do something like that.
That's lovely to know. Wow.
Because I know with Mango at the moment, you guys are at a point where you're self-funding projects. You can do that.
Yes, absolutely. It's not easy, but it's better. You know, it really is better, because you really should be in charge of your own destiny, really. And especially these days with social media, and it's more and more common for artists to be doing that.
If they can.
If they can. But certainly gone are the days where you sign, like we did in the US, we signed a 6-album deal. That's how it used to work. They wouldn't just sign you for one, they'd sign you for 6. Their option, not yours. Mm. So you'd get hamstrung sometimes. If they dumped you, you wouldn't be allowed to strike up a relationship with another record company in that territory. So that's improved for artists.
Do you feel like that deal was a good idea?
It was just that was the industry sort of norm. That's how it was. You were ecstatic if they wanted to do that, because you sort of assumed it would all go well, and then you realize that not necessarily, you know.
Right.
And these big, powerful record companies who spit you out and, you know, chew you up and spit you out for breakfast.
Which is really interesting, because now, and I mean, I know a lot of labels listen to the show, so I mean, I'll be very, choose my words very carefully, but I mean, now there's a lot of artists who actively say, well, I don't need a label, and I don't need to be affiliated. I can go and I can stream, and I can have a distributor, or I can do it myself.
Yes. I still like, we've got a very good partnership with Warner, with the Faces to the Sun album. I still like having that presence, having people who are really professional and, you know, the things that we're not particularly good at, they are good at. So, yeah, I'm not one to take on the whole shebang. You know, you want to know what's going on and everything, but I'd rather have some professional people involved as well.
It's very difficult, don't you find, if you do become really good at one thing, to have to understand that you're not necessarily good at everything.
No, it is. You're absolutely right. You know, you can try. I mean, I've tried my hand at, you know, the business side of things, and I've got an understanding of enough of it. But there are some things you just think, let's get a professional for this.
But at the same time, it's weird, right? Because you think, well, I'm Claire Johnson. I can go on stage. I can command thousands of people. And of those people are lawyers and accountants, yes, and all who are you know, enamored by the enigma of me. But then surely I should be. Why should I not also be able to do all the things that they can do?
Because
do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, and yet, you know, there are different skill sets, and you know, I'm in awe of people who do things that are completely different to what I do. Those are the people who I admire more than people who are in my own industry.
Your icons and your heroes. Yeah. Well, I would imagine it would. Yeah, of course it would be.
You know, it's the people who do things that I couldn't do that I think, wow, that's impressive.
100%. Yeah. What's the the talk going into the, because we're less than a month away now from.
It's actually, I'm going to scare myself. It's 10 days.
Is it as much as 10 days? Because it's the 9th of March.
It's the 8th of March. And the 9th of March.
Right.
Yes.
Monte Cassino Teatro.
That's it.
30th year anniversary concert. I mean, what's the. Going into that, I mean, what have you got planned? What are you going to do?
Oh, we're very excited because as much as we do gig regularly, this is a different thing because it's, you know, it's the theatre. So you've got to think in terms of a big, beautiful theatre, and you have an intermission. So you structure your show in a particular way. So we'll have some surprises. There'll be some AV. It's going to be quite emotional because it's, you know, we're structuring it in such a way that it's hopefully going to just move people and take them down memory lane. Because I know with me, just looking back at old press clippings and listening to versions of songs I haven't heard in a while, because we're obviously thinking carefully about what to put in the show, it's made me just think about the past in a good way. So it's going to have all of those components, but it's mostly just going to be fun. You know, the band's very happy, very crazy, huge amounts of energy. So we're super excited.
And it's sort of like going home to mom, and the photo album comes out in a way.
Yes, it has been a bit of that. You know, especially putting together the program where we wanted to have images that, you know, strike up memories and all of that sort of thing.
Tug on the heartstrings.
Yeah. In a non-mawkish sort of way.
Well, but genuinely so.
Genuinely so. Yeah. Absolutely.
But it's the theatre, so it must work.
It's got to have that sort of... Gravitas is too big and serious a word. But
we're performing at the end of the day. And yes. we're performing real life. We're performing... Yes. You want to have it... If you're proud of what you've done, you want it to be perfectly polished.
We certainly do. With just, you see, the band's mad enough that there'll be those sort of, there'll be that excitement. We're not going to suddenly get all careful and polite and, you know.
Act like it's all just been a show.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
I was very interested to, because while we still have a bit of time to talk to you about, I know that you have a massive sort of... fear and feeling about humanity and people becoming detached and not remembering things that really matter, and you know, when it comes to sort of like technology corrupting the mind and nature being really important. I mean, do you see us getting better or worse at that kind of thing?
I think it's a bit of a mixed bag. I think the problem at the moment is it's a numbers game. There are so many people, and life is tough, and life is intense, and the pressure is huge on people. And I think as a result, we aren't taking time to actually smell the sort of proverbial roses. I mean, going out into nature, and you were talking about the fact that that's something that's important to you.
Incredibly so, yeah.
I've into a habit most mornings when I can with my neighbor. We go for walks in Delta Park, and that's made a huge difference to my sanity.
What
time
do you go? I'm surprised
levels.
I never run into you. I do that. I live in Johannesburg in Craigle Park.
Oh my goodness, we're neighbors.
Oh my goodness.
I'm in Parkhurst.
Come on now, you see. And I've started going in the evenings now because I'm boxing in the morning.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I go in the mornings before it's too hot, and I take the rescue pug. And apparently my partner says I'm a much nicer person since I've been going on these walks.
It's the most Joburg place, Delta Park, because it's like this amazing green belt in the middle of what's otherwise a very nice area anyhow, but then you've also got these giant power lines just surging through the whole thing.
Yes, it sort of says a lot, doesn't it, really? It says a lot about Joburg.
Yeah, but you have to, you know, we have to get out and do as much as we can.
Joburg's beautiful.
It can be, yeah. We recently had this guy, James Delaney. He's a phenomenal South African artist on the show, and he does a lot of work in the inner city.
Wow.
And just because he's fascinated by the architecture and the different kind of styles that have emerged and cultures and people and migrant cultures that have developed over the years. And he's done some phenomenal work where he just trying to reimagine the sense that a little over 100 years ago, this was... you know, completely submersed in nature.
I know. It can make me a bit sad. I mean, I'm not a Luddite. I am all in favor of progress, but it's got to come with moral progress. And I sometimes worry that we're not getting there fast enough. I don't know. It's, you know, I am optimistic. And I think maybe, you know, we access more information about the world. We are better informed. Maybe we make better choices. I hope.
Yeah. Well, that's why we need autistic types, I think, because at least they ask questions.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
And through the congregation of music, everyone else finds escape, which is also good.
Which is wonderful.
I'm excited. I genuinely am excited for the show. We're going to be there.
Awesome.
8th and 9th March, 10 days away. Good luck. Is it, are you rehearsing every day or is that all done? Well, what's happening at the moment?
We're generally quite well, when I say well rehearsed, we're well.
You're gig prepped. Fit.
We're gig fit. Thank you. That's perfectly said. However, we are adding some bits and pieces in to the show. So that we've had a couple of rehearsals. We're having another one next week. And then, of course, there'll be rehearsals in the venue where we're getting all the sort of dramatic elements in place. So yeah, so lots to do, but it's you know, all doable.
Well, good luck.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for coming to talk to me for the last hour.
It's been such a pleasure.
Claire Johnston, Mango Groove, 8-9 March, 30th anniversary concert, Monte Cassino Teatro.
5 Talks on 5 FM with Nick Hammond. Share stories, change attitudes, celebrate people. Talk loud, listen loud, live loud. 5 Talks on 5 FM.